thanks again, Matt, for joining me today. I'm really looking forward to chatting. Today, I want to talk about subcutaneous isatuximab, which we know just received FDA approval. So we're going to go into some of the drug specifics, a little trial data, and how the agent compares with subcutaneous daratumumab in the market. But before we jump in, I'd like you to introduce yourself and tell our audience a little bit about your experience in the space.
Yeah, no, of course. Thanks for having me. My name is Matt. I'm a pharmacist that practices in Boston at Mass General, and I practice mainly in lymphoma, multiple myeloma. And I think that the advent of CD38s have sort of transformed the treatment of myeloma, especially with the benefit we've observed in terms of patients who receive quadruplet CD38 combinations in the frontline setting. And of course, now with the entry to the market of isatuximab sub-Q, it definitely offers additional option for patients.
Awesome. Thank you so much. So let's talk a little bit about the science and mechanism of isatuximab. So for listeners who know that isatuximab or knows isatuximab as an IV anti-CD38 antibody, what actually changes at the formulation level to make subcutaneous delivery work? And does the mechanism of action on the myeloma cell change at all?
So for isatuximab, again, the drug itself is the same. And I think isatuximab represents a unique anti-CD38 monoclonal antibody in that it does bind to a distinct epitope of CD38 and actually inhibits the ECTO enzyme activity of the receptor. And that's sort of distinct compared to daratumumab. And it may modulate the tumor microenvironment, make it less immunosuppressive. And also, not only that, isatuximab can have direct cytotoxicity upon binding without the need for antibody cross-linking. And also, that's distinct in terms of its MOA as well. Furthermore, and I think it's you need to point out like in terms of why that mechanism of action may be more advantageous, I think specifically calling out patients with 1Q AMPR gain, acknowledging that not only do those patients have less antigen density in terms of lower CD38 expression, but also with overexpression of complement inhibition or complement inhibitors for those patients. And so again, if monoclonal antibodies in that context, if your only main mechanism of action or one of the main ones is to engage complement in terms of CDC or CDCC, then working and having the option for that direct cytotoxicity may hold advantage in those patients. And of course, notable also to state that patients with 1Q abnormalities represent about 40 to 50% of patients in the frontline setting. That aside, in terms of the mechanistic differences between, or specifically for isatuximab, the drug formulation itself, yes, is different. And it's notable that the sub-Q formulation for isatuximab is 1,400 milligrams per 10 mLs or 140 milligrams per ml. It is formulated without hyaluronidase. And of course, it has a total volume per dose of fixed 10 mLs. In terms of the fact that it doesn't have a hyaluronidase, oftentimes some patients might have adverse reactions to hyaluronidase during hard hyaluronidase. And so this presents a subcutaneous formulation that's hyaluronidase free. While there isn't a change to the mechanism of action to the drug, I think we'll get to IRACLIA, and there were certain, there was a subgroup analysis based on extreme body weights in the IRACLIA experience, and patients with lower body weight, less than 50 kilograms, did note to have increased drug exposure as measured by C trough. And again, that kind of makes sense where you're giving a fixed dose. And again, patients with at the lower extreme of the weight range might have increased exposure. And also that does translate to, although an increased incidence of grade 3-4 neutropenia, not a notable increase in the risk for febrile neutropenia.
Great. Thank you so much. So we're going to transition a little bit into the IRACLIA trial, where we saw the success with subcutaneous isatuximab. So the trial showed 71.1% overall response rate in the sub-Q versus 70.5% in the IV group, essentially an identical efficacy. What about the trial design gives you confidence that's a real-world equivalence and not just a small sample coincidence?
I think, again, for IRACLIA, it was a dual primary endpoint in terms of C trough with response. And We did see pretty comparable results that would sort of allude to and sort of confirm equivalence. And again, I think this is further supported by the subgroup analyses. But I think the results of the Heraclea study in terms of ESA PD versus comparing IV and subcutaneous formulations, along with the pharmacokinetic analysis and the subgroup analysis, I think drive confidence that there is equivalence between. And again, the trial didn't meet its primary endpoint. And there's some nuances based on the pharmacokinetic data. But as it relates to both efficacy and safety, the results were notable in terms of supporting equivalence, with also additional safety data that supported the benefit of the subcutaneous formulation. I believe about 1% in change of patients, around like 1.5%, had infusionary reactions with the subcutaneous formulation versus around 20% with the IV formulation. And again, notably, the fact that it's because and likely given the easing into drug exposure with sub-Q versus IV, and then also the fact that you're not as reliant on complement engagement with ESA's mechanism of action, that sort of translates into this very low risk of infusionary reactions. And then, of course, there also was a understandably and also acceptably low incidence of injection site reactions with the sub-Q formulation as well.
Great. So administration of subcutaneous isatuximab uses the circlic device. It's being considered the first anti-cancer agent delivered with an on-body injector. What's actually different about wearing an OBI for isatuximab versus a manual sub-Q push from a patient's chair time perspective?
So before getting to that, I think what is notable in terms of the Heraclea study that there were patient perspective considered, provider perspective, and also nursing perspective. And I think it's also important to call out the ESALCO study, the phase 2 study, where it was a crossover study looking at patients who first received IV and then sub-Q and vice versa. And I think taking that together, patients, nurses, and providers favored the sub-Q OBI formulation. And I think there's one piece of it in terms of comparing among the drug class, but I think the use of the OBI should be looked at distinctly, saying, hey, is there a better way that we can deliver a large volume subcutaneous injection? Is there a better way, regardless of the drug that's in the device, right? But there's aspects of drug formulation in terms of the total volume, excipients used, and the concentration. And so if we're able to optimize the composition of the medication, are we able to deliver a better patient experience without compromising efficacy, but optimizing safety? And I think looking at the survey results and the patient preferences, provider preferences, nursing preferences, they all sort of shifted towards the sub-Q OBI. And there was per the patient survey experience, that it was noted, especially looking at the ESALCO study, because these are patients who received both a sub-Q and IV formulations of isatuximab, and they noted that, hey, if they did receive a sub-Q, it was less painful, and that there's a higher preference to receive the sub-Q via OBI than the manual push for patients that experienced both. And I think that sort of moves us to the actual circlic device. And we're taking a look at the circlic device. Again, we're seeing the interaction of how the drug is formulated, as well as the device properties and characteristics. In terms of the device, it has, in terms of it's holding the 10 cc's of the isatuximab sub-Q formulation. It's notable that the needle gauge is 30 gauge. So this is quite a thin needle, and it's retractable. And again, out of sight for both the provider administering it and also for the patient. And I can sort of envision myself and then yourself, right? If we're in the same room and we're sitting in a chair, and if I was right next to your face, looking you in the eye, holding a needle out of your belly as I'm slowly pushing it in, it's a definitely like way closer than we typically are to any other person in such like an intimate setting. And so it can be awkward sometimes, right? What do you say? What do you do besides like looking at the ceiling? And so I think this is the aspect of a hands-free delivery, where it sort of simplifies that interaction between the nurse and then also the patient. And also it being hands-free then the nurse isn't necessarily like every single couple seconds thinking to himself, oh, how much should I push? I need to go more and more and more. And again, if a nurse is doing this the entire day, of course, it's sensible that repetitive movements, right, can definitely have an effect on the body and can be uncomfortable and painful at times, depending on like, oh, this is my first injection of the day versus like 50th injection of the day. And so that's sort of like the considerations for the device at sort of the point of care where it reaches the patient and also the nurse. The nurse, which is sort of the device is filled with the sub-Q formulation of isatuximab. They place it on. They activate it by pressing the middle button. And then afterwards, the injection or the flow rate accommodates to the patient's body habitus, right? If a patient has, you would suspect that if a patient's plasticity of their deep, of their sub-Q tissue, if it's more plastic, then there's less resistance or pressure. And then the flow rate would be what it is. We would suspect that if there was more pressure in the sub-Q tissue, then the actual injection might take a little bit longer. I believe that the median duration of injection on trial was about 13 minutes. Only about 2% of injections were upwards of 20 minutes. And the idea there is that if I were to inject into someone and did a uniform injection for someone who had, let's say, less or more plastic sub-Q tissue, there could be a variation in comfort or discomfort. And so I think all of that plays into what we saw in terms of patient surveys and both Izalco and Heraclea in terms of, hey, this is less painful. And again, the thought is that we are giving a medication, right, with a uniform amount of pressure. The pressure in the actual sub-Q device is 7 PSI. And so once the device is activated, there's a continuous 7 PSI of a pressure administering this. And the actual pressure is constant, so it's adjusting to the patient's body habitus in terms of the plasticity of their sub-Q tissue. Not only are we sort of having a constant pressure, the actual flow rate is representative of such a small needle in terms of 30-gauge needle. And also the volume we're injecting is 10 cc's, which is less volume than 15 cc's. And then also the formulation does not contain hyaluronidase as well. And so you would expect that the formulation is less thick, although there's no formal viscosity studies to tell us the viscosity index of either formulation of the CD38 subcutaneous formulation.
So that kind of moves us into this interesting positioning that Sanofi is doing, where they're framing isatuximab with the on-body injector as usable not only in clinic, but also potentially at home. So how realistic do you think that an at-home administration process would look, especially considering that anti-CD38 antibodies do have some hypersensitivity warnings that are still on the label?
Yeah, so I believe there was a subgroup in the Heraclea study where after a certain set number of cycles, I believe it was either day 15 of cycle 4 or 15, that a small cohort of patients representing around 50 injections total could have this done at home. So this is a very small portion of patients on the Heraclea study. And again, this device and the actual formulation itself is a needleless reconstitution. And so this is quite a simple streamlined reconstitution as well as administration process. I think this definitely opens the door for at-home administration or increases the possibility or decreases the logistical considerations of it. But I think this gets into a larger conversation in terms of set of care administration, set of care mandates, and this interaction between patients, their oncologists, infusion centers and medical oncology practices, payers, and then also visiting nurse services in terms of VNAs, as well as home infusion pharmacies. And the one thing is that although we can imagine ourselves as patients, and we would, of course, want things that are the safest, but also the most convenient and less stressful for ourselves and our family members, but how do we do that in a sustainable way that ensures safety for both the healthcare providers and also for patients. And right now, I would say that the healthcare ecosystem and infrastructure for care delivery is not optimized or has a clearly sensible, sustainable model for at-home administration of oncolytics. And the thought is that, is there an opportunity for for something where if something is given every other week, right, you would suspect that there would be a pre-treatment visit on the first day of a single cycle. And so would it make sense to have at-home administration where there is also an expectation of needing an oncologist to review labs, clinical status, and just seeing how folks are doing and signing orders? And would it make sense then to have at-home injection for the day 15 administration of said cycles, which was what was done on the Heraclea study? Now, if at-home administration does occur, I think it would require engagement from national organizations that represent the interest of both patients, providers, and also weigh in from a regulatory agency like CMS in terms of how is this going to be paid for and how is this sustainable as well. Because ultimately what this does is that it shifts reimbursement from medical to prescription. And so for community oncology practices that don't have a directly financially affiliated home infusion pharmacy or home nurse service, right, that ultimately they're facilitating the care of the patient, but the reimbursement associated with the drug administration, they're not getting it. And so ultimately the concern is that it compromises the financial health and stability of community oncology practices or practices that don't have the infrastructure to capture that level of reimbursement. And ultimately, if those practices cannot partake in this sort of model where it's sustainable financially, then ultimately what will happen? These practices will close down. And what does that mean? Then that means decreased access for patients, right? And already in a landscape where there are cancer care deserts around the United States in our communities.
Great. Thanks so much for all of that. So kind of moves us into all other positioning of isatuximab subcutaneous. Now talking specifically about the market in comparison to subcutaneous daratumumab. So subcutaneous daratumumab has been around for much longer. It's had a multi-year head start in this space. So what does isatuximab need to prove or offer to meaningfully compete for share now?
So I think ultimately this should be framed on what is the best for the person who is receiving treatment in front of us as clinicians. And so I think when we take a look at the data, again, the data is very compelling for patients in the frontline, both transplant eligible and ineligible for anti-CD38 quadruplet in terms of either isatuximab or daratumumab, in this case, subcutaneous, in combination with RVD. And this is and should be the standard of care. And for patients that are that aren't as fit for a short amount of time, those patients might be receiving a triplet and then maybe change to a quadruplet. Again, given how quickly and dynamic the care landscape is, what is the role of a CD38 in the context of the availability of TC-based combinations? Of course, we've recently have seen the FDA approval of teclistamab plus daratumumab and a biological rationale of combining those two agents where you have the CD30 depleting CD30 positive Tregs and otherwise having a synergistic effect with the T cell engager in terms of the possibility of decreasing the effects of T cell exhaustion in the context of using a BCMA TC alone. And I think in terms of the data that we have data in terms of teclistamab in combination with daratumumab, teclistamab as monotherapy, in terms of a CD38 exposed or refractory patient population from Majestic-9. We have updated data from Monumental-3 in terms of talquetamab plus daratumumab. And of course, we are anticipating the entry of T-cell engagers into the front line in the future, and most likely in the combination with a CD38 monoclonal antibody. And so I think the question there is, what is the optimal combination partner for a BCMA or GPRC5D, or just in general, a myeloma TCE, is that isatuximab or daratumumab? And so I think in that context, we're awaiting more evidence in terms of both safety and efficacy of T-cell engagers in combination with isatuximab and saying like, hey, is there a difference when we do evaluate this these combinations versus Dara-Tech, Dara-Talc-based combinations And once we have that information, we'll better be able to inform the treatment decisions in terms of the optimal treatment selection. And again, this is ever more complicated. Of course, we have the recent approval of iberdomide based on the results of Excalibur R in terms of Dara-Iberdex. And so again, I think this will further add the complexity of the treatment landscape in terms of what is the optimal combination partner in terms of TCs with a CELMoD, a TC with a CD38, and the permutations thereof. And so I think that the introduction of Ezetimibe sub-Q opens the door and often will probably raise more questions than answers. And I think once those data that will be forthcoming in terms of TC-based combination with Ezetimibe will allow us to better formulate what that treatment landscape will look like in terms of what is the role of ESA or daratumumab in the second line and plus setting.
Great. So you had mentioned that, you know, deciding whether or not to choose sub-Q isatuximab or daratumumab, you know, patient populations who are allergic to hyaluronidase, you know, would be better candidates for isatuximab subcutaneous. But when it comes to, you know, other factors that may impact the decision of whether to use sub-Q isatuximab or daratumumab, what other impacts do you think are happening outside of just patient biology and maybe even just provider familiarity? What sort of formulary contracting or reimbursement kinds of challenges or factors should pharmacists consider?
Yeah, I would say that there's a lot of practical considerations with considering adoption, right? The one thing is like being able to have that discussion within practices and saying, hey, what is the value proposition, both in terms of safety, efficacy, and operational, does a new medication offer? And I think with the on-body injector, again, given the fact that there's definitely more subgroup analyses with ezetimibe in patients 1Q and gain, and also in combination with 1Q abnormalities with other high-risk features with ezetimibe that might point to its use in those patient populations. I think that with ezetimibe, it does offer some intriguing differences in its mechanism of action that might make it a more preferential partner with TCs, although those data are forthcoming. I think the OVI itself and also the formulation, when they're used together, are less painful. And per phase 2 and phase 3 studies, in terms of patient perspectives, was viewed upon favorably. And I think that we sort of also eagerly await those provider, nurse, and patient perspectives in the real world from real world evidence. In terms of other practical considerations with the OBI and the sub-Q vial, right? There's a practical consideration of, hey, if I'm ordering this and it's coming together, where you have one big box, and inside the big box is a box for the OBI and a box for the ESA sub-Q. I'm receiving this, right? But there's no way I have enough fridge space to put this entire box in there. And then even if I do put the entire box in there, right, where is it stored? Is it stored on a unit where the nurse will reconstitute it at chair side? Or is pharmacy going to be the one who stores it and then releases it to the nurse to then reconstitute? Or is pharmacy doing the reconstitution? And even from there, the thought is of like, oh, well, we want to have the ability for scanning the device, because how can we ensure that the device is being used if we intend to use it versus manual push? And how can we record each step? Even let's say we figure out how we want to dispense it, where we want to dispense it, and we figure out the tracking and ensuring that you have a device that's used in combination with a sub-Q ESA vial and it reaches the patient. There's also nurse education that has to go into just the practical considerations of what the device is, how to use it, the thought of understanding like, hey, what to expect in terms of the injection duration, how long is too long, or when you should double check. And if something were to happen, nurses would need to know that they can pause the injection by pushing on the middle button, but also knowing that when they release the middle button, that the infusion or the injection will continue. In terms of contracting, I think that is going to be between the practice and also the manufacturer, and seeing what kind of contracting and rebates are available with daratumumab versus dizutuximab, and what makes sense in terms of sustainability for the practice, and balancing that with the available safety and efficacy data that's available for both agents. So I think the contracting question is a bit more nuanced and has to be decided at a practice level, as oftentimes contracting can be quite opaque. And it is something where the discussions between manufacturers and practices there, it can be quite nuanced.
Thank you so much for all of that. Really great practical considerations for pharmacists to take away as we see sub-Q isatuximab move into certain settings. So kind of moving now into the bigger picture of what the approval of subcutaneous isatuximab really means for the treatment landscape. So now we have two anti-CD38 antibodies on the market with subcutaneous options across a broad range of myeloma indications. Does this change how you think about anti-CD38 therapy as a drug class rather than two competing brands?
So I would say that the framing of it are two different medications that are distinct from one another in terms of having similarities and also distinctions. And I think it just offers more options for patients when we take a look at the data. And so there's going to be information that is more robust and it can inform treatment, and that might lean one way or the other. I think that there's some practical considerations of practical differences and also differences in treatment schedule as well, in terms of in those contexts with depending on the treatment combination, a line of therapy, oftentimes daratumumab will have less total injections or defined treatment course than isatuximab. And then in terms of differences in terms of monitoring requirements for sub-Q, that in some cases might favor isatuximab sub-Q, and also when you can drop pre-medications and what that sort of looks like. And so I think it just adds another added layer of complexity for healthcare providers, especially pharmacists, and thinking through what the benefits in terms of efficacy and safety in this first line and also second line or plus, and also when things are going to be used in combination that are current combinations, but also forthcoming combinations. And how do we translate all these sort of findings and advances into delivering better care for our patients? And I think one, I frame it in terms of isatuximab sub-Q in the context of the anti-CD38 landscape. But I think I also frame it as that the isatuximab sub-Q OBI, in terms of the circular device, is a proof of concept that we can give sub-Q formulations that are large volume, that is more convenient, that is less painful, and it's a proof of concept in terms of what a sub-Q formulation can be and should be, hopefully, in terms of offering a better patient experience. And so I think this approval is a landmark for the anti-CD38 treatment landscape and the multiple myeloma landscape, but also represents a landmark in oncology care, because like you mentioned, it does open the door of what an at-home administration would potentially look like in the future, acknowledging that we're probably not there yet. But how can we have engagement from relevant stakeholders within the healthcare ecosystem to figure out if that were to be a possibility, what kind of model and what kind of resources would different stakeholders need to have to make it sustainable? And then also, of course, having a patient voice and patient advocacy at the center of that, because ultimately, all of this is to make sure that we can deliver care that is safe, effective, that is representative of where patients are living and where how long they're traveling. And of course, making that and optimizing that experience to be the most convenient and least painful as possible.
Great. So if you had to describe the single biggest practical win from this approval for an oncology pharmacist, what would you say that is?
The single biggest practical win from this approval for the oncology pharmacist is knowing that there is a formulation that is less painful for our patients. And so Because ultimately, I think that the implementing the EastlinkMap SubQ OBI is definitely a not insignificant amount of work. The practical point is that it is a good amount of work to figure all this out. But the reason we're doing all this work is to make sure that, again, for someone with multiple myeloma who's getting these injections through maybe induction, consolidation, and maintenance, that we're saving them that much less pain at every single point of their care. I think that's something meaningful to work towards, regardless of the difficulties and the challenges going through implementing and utilizing the sort of new device.
Great. Well, thank you so much for all these insights. They were absolutely fantastic. It was great to have you on today.
Thank you so much.